Blog Talk Radio.
Simone, 8 years, always ushering the show in perfect style. God bless you. God rest you. Welcome, people, to She's Raising the Bar, Blog Talk Radio. How's everybody out there? This is, oh, my God, it's the final day of Women's History Month. So I'm hoping everybody has celebrated the way they should. You know, supporting women, supporting your sisters, supporting your mothers, supporting your daughters, supporting your partners, supporting your friends. That's how we do it, because it's only going to get done with us. So I'm hoping everybody raise a glass at one point to someone in your life that's important to you, somebody that you could help, and somebody that you could platform proudly and advance them in the fashion that you wish to be yourself. So hello to the West Coast people who are listening to us. It's 10 o'clock there, and you might be having breakfast. So have a good meal. Have low carbs, high protein. Enjoy your meal out there, my East Coast peeps. It's 1 o'clock, so technically you could have a drink if you want, but hopefully you get a little full stomach in there before you do. And our UK peeps, I want to give a shout-out to Vicky Garvey, who's always listening to the show and always raising a glass. It's 6 o'clock there. So you could actually drink without guilt. You could drink there without guilt. It's 6 o'clock, so just enjoy yourself. So thank you for joining the show. Lori Towers is me. And you know something? I could not end this month of celebrating women the better guest than I have on now. And it's a personal thing because this woman has been a dear friend to me for years now. And not only to that fact is she's an award-winning musician and she's a woman who is politically savvy, and I admire that. And I also, that's something that I support. And it's just going to be the perfect ending to this month. And this, anybody's listening to the show, we're political. So if you don't agree with our politics, there's other stations to listen to. That's absolutely fine. But Gwen Laster has been a pioneer as far as spearheading belief system, political, and a wonderful musical landscape. And I just want to bring her on the show. Welcome, my Gwen.
Thank you, Lori Towers, and congratulations.
There we go.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm happy to be closing our Women's Month with you.
Yeah.
And like you say, we're dear friends, running buddies. We know the landscape. We know the lay of the land of New York City and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember, I'm going to give people a little inside scoop to how we met. I moved up to Beacon, oh, my God, probably years ago. And we were, my husband was putting together, it had to be a Woody Guthrie Festival in Howland, which is,
right.
If anybody gets up there on a day trip, you really have to see the architecture of this place. The Howland Cultural Center is just amazing. So we were putting something together there to honor Woody Guthrie. Pete Seeger was going to be there, and you were on tour, and we reached out to you, and you weren't sure that you could make it. So it was like a Saturday night. I can't remember the exact date, but you showed up the last minute, and you sat in with us. And it's one of those things, you know, when you play with other people, you're just like, okay, it was great. I'll see you soon. You know, best of luck, blah, blah, blah. About 3 weeks later, maybe a month, I'm sitting on Metro North. And my stop was Beacon. Your stop was Cold Springs. And I'm sitting there with my headset on. And I'm just sitting there. I'm not really looking at anything. I'm just thinking about my day and going to my office. And here's this woman who stands in front of me. And I couldn't hear anything because I'm listening to my music, and you just motioned the bass. And you looked at me
right.
and smiled. And I took my headphones off, and I said, yeah. And you sat down next to me, and we've been chatting ever since. And that's just
that's
one
right.
of those cool stories that you have, one of those cool stories.
Yeah, then we start connecting on train times, like, oh, are you going into the city on this day? Save me a seat so we could catch up and
yeah,
all that stuff. And sometimes even coming back, we would link up. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know what? As you get older, you realize these little things are really the big things in life. And
oh.
they're just wonderful memories. It's just like really, really cool stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. So here we are, and you have evolved in so many different ways with how you express yourself.
Thank
and,
you.
Yeah, and how you express yourself through your business,
thank you.
Creative directions, and so this is one of them.
Oh, thank
yeah.
you. Thank you. And you know what's interesting is, and we're going to get a little political on this show, and it's fine. You and I did a recording in, I think it was November, and it was right after Biden officially got elected. He was elected before that, but everything came in, and it was like, I think the Saturday before, they were saying that he won. And you
right,
and I had
right.
a recording.
And
it was a great day, and it was, we were in Williamsburg. I think it was Super Giraffe Studios in Williamsburg. And it was one of those hot days in November. It was like 80 degrees easily.
Yeah.
And I remember
yeah.
you and I, we took a break and we're walking around. I went on a wine run. I wanted to get some bottles of wine for the other musicians that were with us.
Right.
And some food.
Mm-hmm.
And Williamsburg was popping. It was, everybody was celebrating. And I remember turning to you and saying, you know what? We're in such a bubble here. Because
right.
we take for granted that everybody here is on our side, but there's other parts
yeah.
of the city that aren't really that happy with the person that won, which was Joe Biden.
That's right. And
remember
even
that?
In Williamsburg, just not too far away, we have the Hasidic Jewish community
yeah.
who
yeah.
Probably are Trump. In that group of people that we're talking about that weren't so supportive. Yeah, this was exactly
yeah.
the day after, if I'm not mistaken,
right.
that
right.
That
yeah.
Biden was officially recognized as winning. And so, yeah, it was
yeah.
we had, I remember that week because Tuesday was Election Day. He didn't officially
yeah.
get acknowledged until Saturday. And Tuesday through Saturday, every single day was sunshine.
Yeah.
Every single day was
that
sunshine.
Was,
I remember that. And Saturday in Beacon, people were walking around with this sense of resolve and this relief. People
yeah.
were just, I mean, their heads were still in the cloud, but we were like, oh, my God, at least we don't have to deal with that. I mean, so obviously COVID was still at its peak.
Yeah.
And so we still were reckoning with that, but at least we had Biden in there, and at least we have some people that we can hold their feet to the fire. It's not over.
Yeah.
We still got to be
yeah.
on their asses like crazy. So, but it's a better scenario for sure.
Oh, my God. You know what? And I always say there's going to be stuff that I don't like that he's going to do. I know that. I know there's going to be stuff
right.
I disagree with. But, man, come on. What a friggin' difference is this? We have adults running the show.
Yes.
We have vaccines that are getting into
in
everybody's
the White
arms.
House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Imagine.
Imagine
if we had this last year at this time, people would have been inoculated. People would have been back into their restaurants, into their venues a lot sooner
yeah.
than they are now. And that's the sad
yeah.
part. That's the sad part.
Yes. Yes, that's the really sad part. Like just before we went on the air, I was telling you about a bar that was a family-owned bar here in Beacon
yeah,
that I just noticed today that didn't make it. And so that's just one example of how many traditional family-owned businesses that just couldn't make it through this
yeah.
whole phase that we're going through, even with the PPPs and the
yeah.
SBAs and all of the other initiatives that were out there. It was just a lot of businesses that couldn't make it, and as a result of that, a lot of families that couldn't make it. So that aren't making it, that are struggling right now, Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, and you and I, even just from a musical standpoint, the first recording I did in the pandemic, and I don't know, I think you've done maybe more, but I remember going to the studio that Saturday, that Sunday morning, and we couldn't see the brass. I mean, you were up in that little crow's nest.
Right.
And I was by John and the drums, and that was fine. It was, you know, again, we had some issues with being audible. But I remember you couldn't look at the horn section because they had to have 12 feet apart because of the spray. And these are things you don't think about. You don't think, because like, what? Oh, and then it makes perfect sense. But this was a totally different way of recording than I remember.
Yeah, I was up in the ceiling in a little room, in a little open space. Up the little narrow stairway, looking down at everybody, and it was an interesting acoustic setting that we all had to adjust to, and so I don't know. In some ways, that made us listen even more, and I mean that's a metaphor for really what happened during this entire isolation is that everybody had to listen more because we were living and coming and producing and presenting ourselves from a different angle than we had been ever. So I just don't think that anything would have had the impact that it has now or that it had then had we not been in isolation. So I'm grateful and I'm thankful for the isolation in that way. I don't feel good at all. I'm very, very saddened by all the people that I know that we've lost and for everybody's loved ones that have passed away directly from COVID or as a result of being isolated. I'm hoping that we've learned our lesson and everybody's talking about go back to normal. Well, no, there's a new normal that we have to create. We don't want to go back to that because that's what's actually got us into this whole situation with the condition of the earth and overpopulation and not being mindful of air quality and pollution all the stuff, you know. So we just have to reorganize, and this time when we come out, we got to be mindful and we got to move forward with our game and with a different path this way. A same path, but different obstacles, different concepts, different ideas, perspectives.
You know, you're right, because I think that we're all, and I get it, we're all like, you know, we just can't wait. We're trying to chew ourselves out of our shackles, and we can't wait to get back to Broadway. We can't wait to do what we normally did. And I have to say, that's not going to happen anytime soon. When I take the train into my office, you know, rush hour is just not the same, and it probably will never be the same because 80% of the work population now could work from home. We've realized that. People could cyber commute. So that's never going to come back, and it might be good, might be bad. But we have to be realistic. Everybody's saying, oh, Broadway will be back in the fall. I don't know. I just don't know. And you've done a lot of Broadway work. So what are your feelings on that?
I've subbed a lot on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And, I'm just reading today in some paper, I don't know which paper it was, but that the variants are rising and numbers are going up and, schools are wanting to open in the fall and have already announced that, you know, a lot of schools have announced we're going to be in person and I don't know. I mean, I was talking to a video projection artist today who's starting to get work for the Met. So she started to work again for the Met. But she says she's not sure what they're doing with the musicians and what the set design is going to be all about. Is every single theater now going to have plexiglass placed there in a certain way? And what are the choreographers going to do? What is the whole stage direction and concept going to be about if we're still having to distance, you know, socially distance, and how many musicians are going to be in the pit, you know. I mean, we already have a limited amount of musicians in certain pits and certainly a limited amount of black and people of color in the pit. So how is that going to be affected if, in fact, Broadway can open in the fall? So I'm with you. I just don't think, I don't think it's going to happen. And I know Midtown needs that business. And I know that that's like the heart of New York City, and in terms of commerce and economics and money-making and all that. We really need that. The city really needs it. But I'm not so sure about Broadway happening in the fall. I mean, I hope it does for those people that are playing Broadway. That's great. I mean, I hope it does happen. But, yeah, so I'm kind of with you on that.
It's hard to see because, again, there's so many structural issues that have to happen to the houses themselves, the theaters. Where's the money going to come from to do that? Okay, they're already in debt. It just doesn't seem like it's anything that, again, we want to be selfish and go back to life the way we knew it, but these people, you know, we have waiters, we had wait staff that worked, you know, had go-sees during the day, you know, did there were swings at night, and that's how they paid their bills. But my thinking is when everybody says, well, you know, we have to look at the economy of New York, the economy is not going to get back into a balance until Broadway does. And that's just, you're talking about, it's a $90 million industry per season. Not going to happen unless we start. And I don't really see it this year. As much as I'd love it, I don't see it this year.
I don't see it. I don't see it this year either, because even if, let's say, the houses are set up appropriately and they do all kinds of design configurations to respect social distancing, what about the house? What about the concert goers? What about the Broadway goers?
I
mean, you can't fill. You're not going to be able to fill a house, I don't think, in the fall. I mean, we got these great efficacy rates on the vaccinations, and now younger population are beginning to be approved, and they just said the Pfizer vaccination is the efficacy rate is 100% for adolescents.
Yeah.
So that means a lot more people are going to be getting vaccinated, but I don't know if that translates into let's sell all the tickets in this 1,000-seat theater every night for the next 6 months. I don't know if that translates to that, and that's the kind of dough that we need rolling in to bring the economics back to Broadway. So, again, you know, we're talking about here what are we learning from this isolation, from this period. You know, I think all those standards are going to have to be modified some way or another if it's going to exist, if something like Broadway is going to come back. That's my thoughts. That's my instincts. That's my two cents.
I think you're right. And, you know, my concern is, again, Broadway at one point was a place that mostly everybody could go to. But now every man can get into Broadway. I mean, if you think about the ticket sales, I mean, it's just, if you're talking about you're taking a family of four out for a night, you park the car, you have dinner, you're talking about a weekend away. That's with Broadway tickets. How are we going to get people in the house without raising the prices? See, that's my concern, too. So people who are out of work, you're going to charge $150 and above for a ticket. How is that possibly going to happen in an economic malaise?
Yeah, I don't know. That's what I mean, is that the entire framework, the model, the standard for the models, for the model of that in the framework is going to have to be modified, and it's going to have to be a lot of philanthropic contributions and like-minded people who are going to pitch in and help make things change, because I think we got to start with baby steps again. Baby steps and then grow it like that. You know, maybe there's not going to be 40 shows on Broadway in the fall. Maybe there's only going to be 10. You know, to start off with one-third capacity of the theater or something. So I'm sure there are many think tanks, there are many panels and corporations and people who are involved in running Broadway that are sitting around thinking about how to get this thing going, how to reopen, because a lot of people's pockets are losing. You know, a lot of people's pockets have holes in them, you know, big holes, just money dropping all out everywhere. So
I can't imagine. I can't imagine getting out of bed in the morning with that debt hanging over your head. Oh, my God. I just can't imagine.
Yeah.
But you know what? Yeah. On a personal note, this is what I want to ask you, because I find it a very interesting thing, because you and I share the same circle of friends.
Right.
And I'm wondering, I'm looking at all musicians and all artists, and I'm wondering how the pandemic affected your instrument, what your artistic movement. And I'm looking at, because again, musicians, it's communal, it's expression, it's playing with other musicians. That's what gets musicians going. And I was watching a lot of the people that we know that couldn't play, they started painting. They started doing something else. How did you maintain your artistic through all this at a time when, in the beginning, nobody could play? Zooming wasn't happening. What did you do? How did you manage?
Well, in May, so we started this isolation process began, in my memory, somewhere at the beginning of the second week in March. And so there was a scheduled out-of-town performance with Melanie Dyer's We Free Strings.
Yeah.
We were going to do the Chicago Strings Jazz Summit. We were going to do that. Travel. There were going to be six of us, I think, in that group traveling to Chicago for Tamika Reed's Chicago Jazz String Summit. And so Tamika, with her forward thinking and just thinking of ways to keep moving through, decided to do it as a live stream. And so with that being said, we Melanie decided to whittle down the group to just a trio. So that would be me, her, and Ken Filiano. And once we had the date, he's great, wonderful person too, great human spirit. I just used that as kind of like a guidepost. And I said, you know, okay, so we've got that coming up in May. I got to come out of this slump and write something for that trio. So after I did that, that kind of, with that commitment and that idea, it made me pick my instrument up, because it was like, I think everybody was kind of paralyzed when this thing first started in March. For me, all I would do is make sure to look at Andrew Cuomo at 11:30 every day to what is going on, what are the statistics. Just like find out what are we doing, and, you know, that was pretty much it. I was getting out and exercising every day early in the morning and then just doing curbside pickup for food and doing some I modified my teaching that I was doing for my young string players here in Beacon at the Holland Center that you mentioned earlier. Of course, we had to cut that down. So then I started teaching on Zoom and kind of learning how to do that whole virtual thing. So everybody was learning that. So I wasn't alone in that respect. But I would say to answer what you put out there is that I gave myself that guidepost of let me write something, because I know if I write something, then I'm going to pick up my instrument to play it. So other than just keeping very physically active and eating real clean and staying hydrated and just being gentle on myself, I just decided, let me start with that. And then as things began to progress and as we got into the warmer weather, there were a couple of outdoor events that happened where I was playing. So that was where my creative forces were, just in they were basically in writing more music, paying attention, staying healthy, trying a lot more new recipes, you know, cooking. I always loved to cook anyway, but so I kept that aspect of it going and reaching out to people that I hadn't reached out to in a long time. I mean, this was the time to check on people and see how people are doing and what are you doing and how are you surviving. And, you know, hey, let's have a Zoom dinner, you know, stuff like that, all that stuff that was going on. So, I guess the closest I got to people, you know, you're talking about real creative people that, that shifted into artwork and all that. I guess the closest I got was to buy some colored pencils, and I would, like, write stuff in my calendar book in different colors. That was as far as I got. Or my calendar where you could trace the flowers, you know, the monthly ink artwork of Joanna Boschford. She had these nice calendars, and I would just color in the whatever she had there. So that was my contribution to my artwork.
But, you know, I think that people would just, again, you know, there are certain people that, I have to be honest with you, I don't like Zooming. I don't like playing with musicians.
Yeah.
I always end up sounding like a tuba with the recording. I just don't like it. So people just try to find anything else to express themselves artistically, whether it was sculpting, whether it could have been planting too. I mean, people were just trying to find different vehicles to do. And you love planting. You've had a garden.
Oh, that I forgot about that. How could I forget that? I said, okay. I started with one raised bed in my backyard, and then that ended up as three. And now that we're rolling back around to spring, I'm thinking about how successful that was and how therapeutic that was to have a beautiful backyard and a deck with flowers and herbs on the deck and kale and all kinds of cruciferous vegetables growing and herbs in the ground. And it was a lot of work, but man, was it satisfying. So I think that was the thing for me. That was the thing for me, is that this gardening was happening. And then everybody around me, everybody was just taking care of their houses. And that's the part I don't want that to change. I want us to be at home as much as we can, and work smarter, not harder. And I actually want less emissions happening on Mother Earth. So get out of that car, get a bicycle.
Walk.
Let's shift into a different mindset here. Let's shift into a different thought, you know? That's where I am right now.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think, you know, shifting into a different thought and a different narrative, I mean, I think that's the one thing that's wonderful that came out of a bad administration and the 4 years of terror that we've had is the movement going forward. I mean, the Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, everybody is kind of raising their voice and letting, you know, their voting rights be known. I mean, we're paying for these people in office, and we need to be met, you know, in like-minded ways.
Yes.
And I have to say, first of all, I love your new CD, Blue Lotus. I love it. And you're never someone who shies away from any political, you know, feature. So you're somebody that doesn't mind letting her music blend with politics, which I think it should. Art should always blend with politics. And I just love the Sandra Bland. That piece is just so powerful, just so powerful. And you let it drop on her birthday. And I think that was absolutely brilliant to do that.
Yeah, her birthday is February 7th, so we previewed the recording with that track, which I named Cigarette. It was in January, and the recording was done, and I said, let me just check and see when Sandy's birthday is. February 7th, okay, good. Let me put a rush on it. Let me drop that preview track on that day, preview of the recording, and then you know, we kept the February concept in mind, and actually the release was a couple of weeks later, the release of the entire project.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that project was born out of my sadness and anger and fear about what was reported about the way that Sandy Bland died, because I knew she didn't die like that, and it really hurt me. It angered me that people would silence somebody's voice in that way, where they would just totally take their lives because somebody's standing up for them for their rights. I wrote the music to the video of the first arrest. So a lot of people might not remember that, but I watched it over and over and over and over and over, because that's how I that's how I wrote the music, was just looking at the progression of what happened and writing, coming up with different themes to the conversations that were going on between her and the officer. And, you know, once he asked her to put out her cigarette in her own car, that's when kind of like everything hit the fan. So that's why I called it, decided to title it Cigarette. The other, I think the turning point or the confirmation that I needed to even start writing the piece was also fueled by my own experience of being pulled over a couple of months before the Sandra Bland tragedy occurred. I was pulled over driving in the outskirts of Cold Spring. So you were in Beacon at that time, I think, when this happened. So it had to be in 2014, 15. Whenever, I think the Sandy Bland tragedy, I believe, happened in 2014, in August or September. I have to check that. But a couple of months before that happened, I'm driving in the outskirts of Cold Spring, not speeding, just headed to Home Depot. Yay, Home Depot. Let's go get some, go have a little nice shopping experience. And I got pulled over, and the officer's asking, you know, is this your car? Well, of course it is. I'm paying monthly car payments. This is my car. They're taking money out of my account every month. Yes, this is my car. Let me see your license. So what happened is, if 2 months prior, 2 months prior to that, my insurance had lapsed for 9 days in June. 9 days when that car was parked at the airport, because I was away doing a residency in upstate Michigan, so had to take care of that while I was away. But 9 days it was lapsed. When he pulled me over in July or beginning of August, a month later or so, that had been taken care of way back in June. So according to his information, the car registration wasn't valid. So he towed the car, took my license plate, searched me, had me sitting in the back of the cop car for 40 minutes or so, trying to find something on me. And so, and I had 2 court dates. Had to go to court twice. So the Sandy Bland incident occurred, and she got pulled over, and I thought, man, because I remember sitting in the back of that cop car, and it was the summer, very hot, and the windows were up in the back. And I thought to myself sitting back there, I'm definitely not going to ask him to roll down the windows, because that would be the thing that I don't know what kind of cop he is. And even though it's daylight, you know, that would be the kind of thing that he would not want to do, just to make me feel uncomfortable. It's like, you know what?
That's exactly right.
I was like, I'm not going to let him know that that it's hot back here. I'll just sit back here and sweat. I don't care. I can sweat it out, you know. So then maybe like after 30 minutes or 35 minutes, he says, oh, the windows are up. So then he put the windows down. So, you know, I guess if I had reacted even to that idea that I'm sitting in the back of this seat, officer, can you please put that window down? Can I have some air back here? Hey, that might have tipped his boat in a certain way, and you never know what happened. So what would have happened? So I'm just grateful that that happened the way it did, and that I wasn't an example.
I don't know if I ever told you this story. I probably did, but the audience should really hear it to give it a direct contrast. I think it was about five years ago. you know, I was in the car. John had gotten out of the car to get some bagels in Park Slope. Okay, so I just came home from work, so I'm on my iPad. I'm looking down. It was a nice, warm day. Windows are open. Now, I was on a bus stop, and I didn't hear the cop say, you have to move. Honestly, I didn't. I was in my head, and I work. Okay. He sticks his head in the car, and on the top of his lungs, he says, I told you to move this effing car. You know my background, Gwen, so I don't have a good reaction to men yelling. I got out of the car and said everything that you don't say to a cop. Everything. You're 5'2" and only a high school diploma. I'm your boss. Who the hell? You can't tell me what I'm doing. You're not my husband. F you. Everything you don't say to a cop. Everything.
Right.
And I didn't get a ticket. There you go.
Wow. Yeah.
Didn't get the ticket. I don't know if I told you this story, but I said, give me your badge. And you know what? We're in Park Slope, and there's a crowd forming. I said, I'm sure there's a couple of lawyers here. Do what you have to do. Go right ahead. You don't ever talk to me like that. You're a civil servant. You don't scream at me like that. You ask me to move my car. I didn't get the ticket. I reported him, and he got into his car. See, that's how the difference is. Me and my waspy-looking self got away with it.
Yeah.
This is what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody else? Well, forget it.
Oh, no. Yeah, anybody else?
Straight to, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. And when people say, and I preface this by saying, there are good cops out there that want to make the difference, but there are corrupt people. There are. And if we say there aren't, we're kidding ourselves. So we have to embrace the fact that there are good cops out there, and the ones that are just trying to serve their community as best they can. But then there's the other ones. And the other ones make the headlines, unfortunately.
Right.
The good cops
The good cops do not make the headlines. It's really unfortunate, but the ones that do wrong, they got to be punished for it. I mean, I haven't seen any of the George Floyd trial. No, I haven't watched it. And
you haven't seen the whole video? Did you see the extended video that they just released yesterday?
No, I didn't see the extended video. I have to check that out. They cannot let this man get away with this. Will be protest unleashed with vaccinations. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, this will be a whole nother level of protesting all over the world, all again. The world is watching again.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, the world is watching again.
This officer is not going to be okay wherever he goes. Honestly, if he gets in jail, if the verdict doesn't work in his favor, jail is not the place he wants to be. So he may as well get his papers in order. But even if he won, he could never. Where can he go? This is people in England are talking about this. He's never going to be okay. I think the worst thing about this video, and I was watching it this morning, was you're watching this, and again, it's just horrific to watch. But I think the most sobering point of it was when another cop goes over to tell him, that's enough, stop it, and he doesn't.
Right.
That's the piece that they never show, and that, I think, makes everybody think differently. Because here's your partner who's saying, listen, come on, stop it, let him go. And you just don't do it.
Wow.
I think that's the hardest thing to watch. And, you know, to realize, as do public officials, wherever you are, there's a camera. Wherever you are, there's a mic. Try to behave and do your job.
It's, I think this guy snapped.
Yeah.
I think that's what happened. He just snapped. Yeah.
I always think that's a job I wouldn't want. I mean, most people wouldn't want that job. It's a low salary, and you have the privilege of making the decision of life and death, and that's too much power for any human being. So we create killing machines, and we desensitize people to go out into battle and go out into policing communities, and then we wonder why they don't respond like a human being. We have to shift that up a little bit. We have to figure out how to make people that beat cop that knew the family, that mm-hmm. knew that this guy is just like, he's acting like a big shot, but he's really a good kid. That's what we have mm-hmm. to go back to.
Yes.
That's what we have to go back to. So
absolutely. I agree with you.
And this is, I think, what the change of the narrative of everything, I think that's...
Yes.
That's what we have to do. But you know what's interesting? Getting back to the music, because we could veer off on this endlessly, you and I.
Right.
There's this, I don't know if you know, Berkeley has a project going out. Terry Lynn Carrington is doing this project. They're creating a book called Women and Changing the Jazz Narrative. And
mm-hmm.
it's showing women who are not just singers. And again, you know, how would her vision is, how would music sound if women in the 40s and the 50s were allowed to play their instruments? And I think it's brilliant.
Wow.
Because it's like, okay, how would it sound? How would it sound?
Mm-hmm.
And again, we're thinking about, okay, the singers, the Billie Holidays and the Sarah Vaughans and everything, and everything that the men gave us permission to do.
Mm-hmm.
What about the tuba players? What about the brass players? What about Barry Sax players? What
oh,
about the
yeah.
double bass players? How
mm-hmm,
would it have
mm-hmm.
sounded? And I think
mm-hmm.
that's, I mean, in your opinion, how
that's
do you think things would have been different?
I think that women still would have been smashed. I don't think they would have been allowed mm-hmm. to do it that
mm-hmm.
early on. I mean, there's a few instrumentalist that kind of crept in there. There's the, you probably never heard of her, Ginger Smock, violin player.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One
yep.
of Stuff Smith's proteges, and she
yep.
was in an all-woman's
yep.
band, on first woman to lead a band on a national television station. I think it was CBS or something, one of the real old stations. So there were only going to be a few that were going to be in, and then if you, I just have to be real, because the whole colorism thing was definitely
mm-hmm.
in motion back then, as it still is. So if you see any pictures of Ginger Smock, she
mm-hmm.
could, you know, she might have been biracial or something like that. So
mm-hmm.
that
yeah.
may have been something that would have be acceptable on camera. Like, oh, I see she's not
mm-hmm.
white, but at least
mm-hmm.
she's not a obviously looking,
mm-hmm.
obvious looking
yep.
black face. So I'm sure that had a lot to do with it. But I think pretty much women would have still been squelched, you
yeah.
know. To answer the concept of Terry Lynn Carrington, I think the music would have been off the chain, crazy,
mm-hmm.
crazy, inventive
yeah.
and creative and groundbreaking and skillful, and women with great sound and ideas and able to translate those ideas into concepts and compositions and great musical conversation. I think it would have been at least as good as what was already out there that was projected by improvisers
yeah.
and jazz players and creative players that were men. It would have been
yeah.
right there
yeah.
with them, if not better, you know.
Yeah.
So.
And you know, yeah. And you know what's interesting? I always love old movies. And the thing with old movies is, when you watch them, even if the classic that I love, you know you're going to cringe at one point because something is terribly inappropriate. And that's just the way it is, because it was done back in the day. So
mm-hmm.
I'm always of the thought, don't censor the movie. Talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about it. Talk about why it's wrong. Talk about why it's infringing on people's natural, wonderful features into humanity as opposed to the stereotypes that you're making them represent. And I was watching, I forgot what it was. It was 5:30 the other morning. Doris Day was in some sort of band, big band, and she's playing a double bass. And I'm just watching her neck hand. And I'm just seeing, but they're just making her just tap it. They're just, and I'm just like, they didn't even care to make, okay, you know what? Hold the C here, do this, do that. They didn't even care about what it looked like because it was a joke. And you realize, my God, there were these serious musicians then who had value and import, and they never reached the stage. They never reached the stage.
Tons of them. And that idea, that thought and that mechanism is still in place today, and that's 80 years later or so, or 90 years since then, you know? So it's pretty sad. We still got a long way to go.
Now, you know, again, I'm thinking about me at 16 walking into a Sam Ash and trying to pick up a bass, and every guy in the store wanting to hold it because maybe I'll drop it. That was then.
Oh,
that was like in 1979. How have things changed, and how haven't they changed from your standpoint?
In terms of just women on the bandstand in general, or?
Everything.
Well, I'm going to zip back to Broadway, and I happen to know that is still a white male-dominated industry.
That's what I wanted you to say.
That is definitely still a white male-dominated industry. Mm-hmm. So just because we were talking about Broadway, and that's why it's getting all the hype about we got to bring it back, because if it was some kind of other black industry, then it wouldn't be all the hoopla out there. So a lot of the contractors are white. I would guess a lot of the people that are producers, I guess, that are above the contractors are white. And certainly as a musician, this is we're talking tiers down from producers and all of that stuff. But as a musician, definitely most of the producers, conductors, I should say, most of the conductors are white. I mean, in fact, I don't think I ever played a show with a black conductor. I mean, I subbed Porgy and Bess. I subbed King and I. I subbed Miss Saigon, Carousel, Beauty and the Beast, all white conductors. And of course, in the pit, well, Porgy and Bess did have a few more black players down there in the pit. But a lot of black players are going to be on the rhythm instruments, are going to be over there on bass, drums, guitar. Yeah. I think that's a whole other little stereotype that's going on with the contractors, and they figure, all right, I got to have a certain kind of sound, so I'll hire the black players on the guitar. I'll hire the black players to play the bass and the drums, but in my string section, that's got to be less, you know, so I don't know. I feel like the energy that you put into trying to get a chair or sub on Broadway, you could just workshop your Broadway show with, get together with somebody that's a screenwriter or something. I'd rather my energy be in that direction because I can kind of see what's going on with Broadway, and this has been going on for a long time. I kind of remember a story from a friend of mine, a cellist, who was in some of the first black shows on Broadway, and there was there still might be this rule that there's supposed to be three to a certain percentage, a low percentage of players of color on Broadway. So this is back in the 80s probably or 70s when this cellist, Akua Dixon, was playing some of the first shows like Dream Girls and all of that. And there was a black conductor, forgetting his name, but he decided to flip it and say, since we got to have at least 3%, well, I'm going to have maybe 90% blacks and just maybe 3% other. And the show went on for a while, but after that show ended, this guy was blacklisted for doing that. So that is this whole idea of do as I say, but not as I do. You know, we can do that on you. Yeah, we can do that on your end. We can keep you guys kind of shackled down to only a certain number of players of colors, but you can't deny us from still having the majority in that whole idea of what Broadway is all about. So, I'm happy to see more black shows coming up, and they should, and it should still continue to be more and more and more and more and more. Because we it's still a low percentage, so if it's anything's got to do with me and being associated with Broadway, to me my talents would be better served to collaborate with somebody and write some music, write some arrangements, you know, in that way, so that you have a little bit of control, depending on who your team is, depending on who you're collaborating with, and creating the face of Broadway, balancing it out, so it is going to be more players of color there, you know, black everything, you know, Latinx, all of that, you know, should just be more of that, because why not? We're here, and we're qualified to do it, so let's open that up.
And need I say, forget about Broadway, symphonies, the mess. I mean, this is something that's just a club that you can't get in. And unfair. It's just terribly unfair.
Yeah.
So that's like
the
wall that you can't climb.
Yeah, yeah, that's really tight. I think the percentage of people of color, black Latinx people of color in the symphonies may be at most 5%. I'm almost sure about that. Yeah.
I don't think you're wrong.
Yeah.
I don't think you're wrong. I'm sure it's that little.
Yeah. It's definitely that little. You know what was interesting about Broadway? And there's a lot of people that I played all kinds of gigs with on Broadway, and there were two black women that actually got me in and returned my phone call and were like, okay, let me see what I can do to get you in. But you call all these other people, and sometimes, you know, they don't even call you back.
Yeah.
Or if they do, it's so many months later. It's like, you know, You have a chair on Broadway. That is like the bottom of the totem pole, and your part and your place in the grand scheme of things is so small that why wouldn't you call me back? I mean, how long do you think you're going to have that gig? You know what I mean? Like the least you can do is call back, but that may be just old school freelance thing. I mean, for me, I generally will call people back, but it's part of the industry. Some people don't call back, and that is their answer, that I didn't call you back, and that's a no. So, you know.
That's horrible.
I kind of got over that a long time ago. So, but it's just interesting to see that there are people who have those chairs. And in the grand scheme of things, how temporary all of that is. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you know what? We can't rewrite the past. What's in the future for you?
Continuing to explore on my instrument in any genre that I like. Right now I'm listening to a lot of our Native Daughters. Which is that group with Rianne Giddens and Amethyst Kai and two other women who are a banjo band.
Oh wow!
And if you listen to any of Rihanna Giddens' music, she's always storytelling and folktelling and history telling, and so she will always play some. some music that she's written, but she will always check back in and give you a little insight into folk music, into history of African American culture. And she will do some covers, and she will always cover women who have been unnoticed and unheard of. So if you get a chance, just check out our Native Daughters. They got a new, I think Rhiannon was asked to put together a tour to include these other three women. So they're all banjo players, and they were, this tour was assembled through the Smithsonian. And so this recording that they have out is amazing. I've been listening to a couple of tracks from it every day. There's a track on there about, it's called Polly Ann's Song, and it's about John, John Henry's wife. And they gave her a song because she's a strong woman, and after she lost John Henry, you know, she was still, she was widowed and still raised the kids.
Yeah.
And there's another track on there. I mean, but they're brilliant players and singers and multi-instrumentalists, all of them. Yeah.
I'm writing this down as you speak. Yeah, I'm writing this
down. So, that's just getting back to your question about how things affect me and how things are currently kind of taking the temperature on what's going on and with women and this struggle that they have and this this uneven kind of parallel bar of getting to where they want to go. So, you know, the Native Daughters would be something you would want to support. In other words, you know,
definitely.
Just what they're doing, where they're coming from.
You know, I was taken by a quote that you made in an interview that I just couldn't get away from. And before you leave, I want you to elaborate on it. You don't pick your instrument picks you. And I just love that. And I said, you know what? Before she goes, I gotta get her to talk about this a little bit more. I just love that quote.
Yeah, I think. My educational, my teaching philosophy is based on that, and whatever students I run across, be it once or twice or for a week in a master class or residency or even any students that I teach consistently, I never expect that they will stick with the instrument. I'm teaching to use the instrument as a different vehicle, as a way of creating, developing team building skills, to develop self-esteem, musical self-esteem, individuality, uniqueness, self-expression. That's why one of the goalposts in my teaching is improvising and composing, because both are the same. When you're an improviser, you're a composer. And when you're a composer, you are an improviser. And so if, in fact, that instrument that we're communicating through, whether it's violin, viola, or cello, if that instrument speaks to you and through my philosophy of how I'm teaching you, then that instrument is going to choose you, and then you'll continue to do that as something that you want to do as part of your life, as part of your life portrait. So that's what I mean by your instrument chooses you, is that you know, you can be introduced to it, but whether or not it's going to connect with you, it's going to choose you. And then you then connect with it, and that'll be what you do. So, yeah, I mean, it's not about, for me, trying to make every kid or every group or every ensemble or every chamber group that I'm doing work with to make them all disciplined music majors who are destined for professions in the music industry only. And, you know, I think that's pretty narrow. So that's what I mean about your instrument choosing you.
Yeah, I love that. It stuck with me. And, you know, the funny thing is, because you're a classically trained musician, A lot of classically trained musicians that I've run into, you can't improvise, but you have absolutely no problem doing it. And there's this thing, the air brakes come on. If you ask a classically trained musician to improvise, it's not going to happen. Just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
that's tough. It's just, you know, it's, I've always thought music is expression, and it's just what's going to happen? What's the worst that could happen? You know, just dive in.
The worst that can happen is the best when you're improvising and you're investigating and researching through your instrument and noodling around. And I just love that. I love that when I'm teaching and somebody is trying to dissect and interpret and understand what I said and what we're talking about, and they're using their instrument to work it through what they're thinking about in their brain. That's like brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
That's genius to me. You know,
and
that
that's
is
another,
genius.
This shows you how much I love you. This is another quote that I wanted to circle. You had mentioned when you're scared enough to take the risk, and that's another quote that I loved in the video that I saw of you, and it's just, that's it. You know, okay, you have nothing to lose. Jump. It's okay.
Jump.
What's the worst thing?
You're not going to go to jail if you play a note that maybe you could have chosen to play another note. It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
There's no musical jail. You're not serving time. You just keep going.
Mm-hmm. That's
just
exactly
keep going.
Right.
That's the whole idea, is to keep going.
Yeah. And, you know, I think everybody in rec plays a solo that they don't like, and they could have done it better, you know, when they were calm or with a glass of whiskey or whatever. And that's fine. But that's what it makes you at the moment. That's what you felt at the moment. So you're being true to yourself, and don't overthink it, and don't go back and retrace it.
That's right. It's gone.
It's
gone.
Exactly.
Create new and fresh thoughts as they come to you, and do what you can do through your instrument. I mean, and that's for all levels of kids. This is not any kind of advanced, professional kind of language that I'm talking about. I'm talking about very day-to-day basic ideas. You know, you don't have to have a vocabulary of 5 octaves on your instrument or anything like that. I'm talking about just rhythm with 3 or 4 notes, or 2 or 3 notes, and the idea that you're thinking about how do I do this different? How do I let this come out a little different this time instead of that way that I did it before? So not that there's anything negative about learning traditional and classical, because that's so important to be able to execute and look at those notes and be able to transfer that note to the right finger with the dynamic, with the bowing, with the articulation, with all of that. So valuable.
Yeah.
But it's also, for me, just as valuable to be able to turn that around and come from the inside and create, you know, especially for classical players that I run into that are more advanced and have been playing for 10, 12, 15 years, and they're now college age and adults. They've got such a vocabulary to tap into to be able to improvise and to create melodies and variations on melodies. It's all right there. You just haven't learned how to tap into that.
That's exactly right. And, you know, it's all communication. It's all being relaxed and listening and speaking.
Yes.
And that's it. And both have to balance. I mean, you have to listen and speak. And that's life in general. That's our dialogue. Before you leave, because you and I could go on forever like this, before you leave, is there anything you want to mention? I'm going to put your website on a Facebook page tomorrow. Is there anything else that you want the listeners to hear? You want to shout out anything that's going on, gigs, whatever?
I want you guys to, of course, check out Blue Lotus. When you go to my website, you'll see Blue Lotus right on the first page, and you can get it at Bandcamp. And I just have to share this just because I just got a text, which is a new review from Blue Lotus. It says, a nice excerpt, Laster's genius is undeniable, and New Muse Quartet only amplifies this fact, making for a meticulously formulated social justice piece, we're talking about social justice piece, distinct from freedom songs known and loved. So this just came to me in a text, and we're talking about social justice. So, you know, all you listeners out there, just check it out. I hope you dig our sound. This is a record of another violinist, a violist and a cellist, and Shen-Wei Shang, Melanie Dyer, who also has her We Free Strings group, and Alex Waterman, who is an amazing composer and a free improviser in his own right. And basically I had a concept like a band. We had the charts. I wrote some notes. I left some parts open for improv. And these players in New Muse Quartet just took it, and we worked it, and we collaborated, and we had conversation, and they just created this whole thing about it. And one other important thing is to notice that the cover of Blue Lotus.
I love the graphics.
The artwork is from Louis Maliu Jones, who's a Harlem Renaissance visual artist who did this piece she often had to take her work, she had to mail her work in during that time as opposed to showing up, as opposed to delivering the work in person, because museums would reject them because they had been done by black female artists. So the piece is called Initiation Liberia, and it talks about the Sande Society and the initiation ritual for women. So that's what this is all about. If you see the swath of white paint across the young woman's eyes on this mask here, it indicates her role as an initiate in the Sande Society. So you want a little – the whole record is just all about uplifting women. It's all about uplifting women and underserved people. And so – If you want to check it out and hear some strings and just support women, please do tap in.
And you know what I always find enormously annoying is when people say, "Well, you know what? I don't want people getting up at the Grammys making political statements. You know, just play the music, just go on stage. You don't have to make a political statement." And I'm always thinking, why? If we are so enmeshed in worrying about the royals and everything that's going on in people's lives and their sex partners and their relationships, why, if we're so involved in that, why can't we be invested in somebody's political leanings and then making a statement? I don't have to agree with it. I don't have to agree with it. But say it. That's fine. If I don't agree with what you're saying, I change the channel. But you have a right to say it. And, you know, as an artist, you have a platform and you should use it. And I never could understand why people have a problem with that. It doesn't make any sense.
I don't know why either. Well, those are people that just want to know just about what you said. They just want to know whose gown are you wearing?
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Whose jewelry did you borrow from Tiffany's or whatever? Who is your partner? Who is your lover? What school, how many kids do you have? What's your family life? What's your personal life? Just not about the overall concept of why some actors take roles that they do and what they're doing beyond that. And, you know, a lot of those, you know, actors are social activists too. There's some of them just won't take certain roles if it's not going to be something that addresses a certain issue. And we got a lot of them out there like that, thank God, you know, that are like that. So,
Thank God. You know, again, it's just a matter of, I mean, look, if you're turning down a role means you have to, you know, you can't feed your kids, that's a different story. But if you have the option of saying, you know, this is demeaning to my culture, my gender, whatever, my belief system, don't take it. And I think more people should think like that.
Yeah. Absolutely, because that's the only way we're going to function from the ground up, grassroots, so we can change things. That's the only way we even got to where we are right now. That's the only way Georgia was won.
We're not where we should be.
Yeah, that was the only.
And I'm hoping in our lifetime we see it. But if not, as long as we get there, you know what, as long as we're making baby steps forward, I'm good with that. Gwen, thank you so much. I'm enormously proud of you, and I love you tremendously. And just keep doing the good work, honey.
I love you, too, and thank you for having me on here.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And all your information.
Keep raising
the
bar. Keep raising the bar. Keep raising the bar.
Thank you, darling. Thank you. You be
safe.
So we'll talk to you soon, Gwen.
We'll talk soon. Okay.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
Gwen Laster. Bye-bye, sweetheart.
Bye-bye.
And there she goes. And, you know, this is, you know, if this is a too preachy a show for you, you know, there's other things to listen to. Or you could come back later and listen to it with whiskey or whatever makes it feel safer to you. But way to end Women's History Month. It's about, and you know what, if today is the last day of the celebration, my thought is keep it going. Keep the party going. This is just not something that should be a calendar marking. It should be something that you do daily. If you have to really look at, and I don't want it because they're like, oh, well, you know what, feminists hate men. We don't hate men. We hate the structure they created. And again, they might not have known better, but the act of backbiting and women being catty was a male-induced mechanism. That's really it. And it always worked because what you do is you make the weak, the link weaker by pulling it. Create a solid union in whatever we're doing and whatever mindset we have. They're going to win. And this is what happens all the time. You reduce the strength of the masses by separating them. So women, keep this in mind. Make a checklist. And in my head, this might sound corny, I have a checklist every day. Did I hurt anybody? Did I support somebody? Did I make somebody feel stronger? This is what we have to do to our sisters. Tell them they look lovely. Tell them they're potent. Tell them they're talented. Tell them they're powerful. Tell them that they make a difference and they make a difference in your life. And this is really the only way we're going to do it. So on that note, close out the month, Women's History Month. I love my sisters. I love my Gwen Laster. I love everybody that's been on the show. Let's support each other today, every day, and not just on these days that we're anointing a month. Get out and protest when we have protests again. Get out and celebrate women's marches, women's, all the people that matter. And when something doesn't seem like it makes sense to you, if you're at a cocktail party, when we have those cocktail parties, and there's something that you don't really agree with, and it seems sexist, it seems racist, it seems misogynist, speak out and say it. You don't have to yell. Say it nicely. Get your opinion out there because you know what? Somebody might listen to you. Somebody might say, you know what? I never looked at it that way, and you've changed mind. And that's all we're trying to do. That's all we're trying to do. So, people, next week we have my lovely friend Patricia Martin on the show. It's National Poetry Month. So we're going to infuse that month with more artistry. And she'll be the first one on to introduce her book, In Venice I Could Sing. And I've mentioned her. She's been on the show in the past, and I've mentioned her book, The Right Side of 40, I'm sure many times ad nauseum. And she'll be on with me next week. And in the meantime, wear your masks. Be careful. Still enjoying Passover. Happy Passover to everybody. As we go into Easter Sunday, you know, it's a faith, it's a combined faith. Do something wonderful. Give back to the planet. Think of resurrection, not just biblical resurrection, the rebirthing of spring, the rebirthing of our soul, the rebirthing of mindset. Let's think of that and go out and make it a wonderful day. And as always, the lovely Nina Simone is going to take us home. Goodbye, everybody. Take care. Be safe.